me what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, take your time to ride.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, I'm a Bentley Benz. But you're moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast. Be-da.
Welcome to Time Out. I am your host, Sylvia Crawley Milbury, and I have an interesting show lined up for you tonight. I don't know if you all had a chance to see Iyanla Fix My Life, but tonight I have Shamiqua Holeslaw, and this show we're going to talk about some things that she learned from being on Iyanla's show about herself, about her mother, and things that she's doing to move forward. I had an opportunity to play USA basketball with Shamiqua Holeslaw, and let me just tell you, she has one of the biggest hearts of anyone I have ever met in my entire life. So I was really adamant about getting her on the show because it saddened my heart just to see the way the media was portraying her during her incident. And so I wanted my listeners on Time Out, and I wanted the world to kind of get to see what I know and see within Shamiqua. And so without any further ado, Shamiqua, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for being here tonight.
Well, thank you for having me, Sylvia.
Oh, no problem. All right, we're just going to jump right into it. You grew up in Queens, New York, and it was just you and your brother in terms of siblings. And your mother was an alcoholic growing up, so you often had to take care of your little brother. Talk about what it was like for you as a kid growing up in Queens, New York.
It was really tough. When I came to the realization that my mom had a drinking problem, I knew I had to do whatever I had to do to survive. And if that meant, you know, taking money out of her purse, you know, when she was passed out drunk, so that me and my brother could have food and be prepared for the next time that it occurred. My mom, you know, she tried the best that she could, but, you know, that disease was eating at her. And even though my dad was in the household, he had his own struggles with alcoholism also. So it was really tough. But, you know, they tried their best, but it was just an unfit situation.
Right. Talk about your relationship with your father. That's something that really wasn't mentioned when you were on Iyanla's show the other night. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with him?
Yes. You know, they edited a lot out, but me and my dad was actually very close, a typical, you know, daughter and dad relationship. But what I found out during my sophomore year in college was that my dad was schizophrenic. And a lot of the times when I thought my dad was drunk and, you know, just, you know, behaving belligerent, it was actually his mental health issues. And once I started seeing that and hearing that my dad was found on the side of the road hitchhiking, it really impacted me. It really made me sad. You know, I got really down. But I was in the midst of my career. I mean, we were winning national championships at Tennessee, so I had no choice but to kind of, like, sweep it under the rug and move forward.
Right. And so your grandmother took you in when you were about 11 years old. How did your life change when you moved into your grandmother's house?
The word that comes to mind is the stability. She supplied stability, just a lot of support. My grandmother was heavily involved in the church, and so it was no more running around the building, no more riding the subways at, you know, 10 years old, you know, hopping on the mattresses outside. It was structure. You know, you're going to get up, you're going to go to school. After school, you're going to take off your school clothes, do your homework, and then you can go outside and play. You don't go to church on Sunday, you can't play basketball. You're not going to hang out in front of the building. You can go to the Boys and Girls Club. Everything had to be constructive. So it was really great for me. I mean, my grandmother taught me etiquette. She just taught me, like, a lot about growing up and one thing about it, she was like, listen, I don't want you to do no dishes or I don't want you to cook. I just want you to be a kid because obviously in my parents' household, I didn't have that opportunity.
Right. A lot of times when you're raised by your grandparents, sometimes it's tough because your grandma is much older than the other kids' parents, so they tend to be
yes.
a little more strict and sometimes out of date with the latest fashions. And mm-hmm. so did you experience that, or was your grandmother a young, hip, kind of cool grandmother?
No, my grandmother was out of date. I remember one time when I had to get some basketball shoes, and my mother, you know, they bought me all the latest fashions. I wanted some Jordans, and my grandma's like, no, I'm not paying $100 for some shoes. And so I remember she got me some, I think it was like Turntex or something, and I went to practice with those on, and all the kids made fun of me. And I remember going home, Grandma, can you please buy me some shoes? But it was things like that. But for the most part, see, since my grandmother was older, and more stable in our neighborhood, that's where everybody hung out. I wasn't allowed to hang out at other people's houses or spend a night. Everyone spends the night at my house. And I used to complain, Sylvia, complain all the time. But as I became older, I realized it was probably a saving grace because, you know, when you have kids, you never know what's going on in someone else's home. And mm-hmm. I could see why my grandmother, you know, was protecting me.
Right. So basketball became an outlet for you in so many ways, especially for what you were dealing with at home. Do you think that's what drove you to be the best?
Yes. I think that I put all my energy, all my emotions into the game. I knew, coming from New York City, you know, growing up where, you know, me, Lamar Odom, and Ron Artest come from, we know that basketball is, you know, our ticket, you know, out of the projects, out of the hood. And so I was like, okay, you know, these people around me, you know, colleges are coming to watch me play. You know, this is my ticket. So when I was, my grandma used to tell me, I used to have like these temper tantrums because I was mad with my parents. And she's like, let me tell you something. You take this out on this in this house, because out there somebody can hurt you, or you take it out in the basketball court. And I would definitely do that. I would have my temper tantrums in the house, and I would go out there on that court and just put everything into it. And I think that's what really fueled me as a player.
Right. So, I mean, I've played with people who join a team because they wanted to be a part of a group, and the team was their family. I've even coached some players like that. And in their mind, everyone on the team was their sister, you know. So it was different for me. You know, I played because I love to play, and the team, those were my teammates. But in my teammates' eyes, the one who joined this team for it to be a part of her family, we were her sister. So when things were, if we didn't have good chemistry, she felt unbalanced. You know, she felt like her family was having a fight, you know, or it was
yeah.
more personal for her. Was that the case for you? Was basketball your basketball team? Was that your family?
Definitely. When I went to growing up, you know, I played with a bunch of guys. So no, you know, we're always just out there competing and roughing each other up. When I went to high school at Christ the King, that's like probably the first time that I really played with girls. And it became like an instant sisterhood. I mean, to this day, I keep in touch with a lot of the girls. And, you know, we have our AAU band, you know, driving 8 hours, singing these corny, cheesy songs. Those were my sisters. They were my family. And then the same thing when, you know, I moved on to college. You know, Coach Summit, you know, that's one of our things at Tennessee is, you know, once a Lady Vol, always a Lady Vol, and, you know, the sisterhood. And so, you know, I just had amazing friendships there, and it feels really good to know that you're not just, you know, playing the game, but you're out there playing for one another.
Right. You talk about Pat Summit. You played for University of Tennessee under Pat's tutelage.
Mm-hmm.
Describe your relationship with Pat, because she could be a stern coach at times. there's a lot of people that feel like it's hard to play for Pat. Describe your particular relationship with her.
Wow. When I first went to Tennessee, here was like this New York City kid. You know, I had that chip on my shoulder, and I'm like, this lady is like screaming at me for everything. I was just like over it. We definitely bump heads. It was multiple times that I'm like, I'm taking this bus back to New York because I didn't have enough money for a plane ticket. So, you know, I'm like, I'm taking the bus back to New York. I'm calling my grandmother. I'm transferring, not knowing that she had called my grandmother already saying, you know, I was hard on Shaniqua. She's going to call you. She's going to want to transfer. But once we started getting, like, deep in the season, especially after we won our first championship, man, I realized that we fueled each other. Like, this was the one person that could just get, you know, just basically just yell at me, get on me. And I had to prove to her, whatever she told me that I couldn't do, I had to prove to her that I could do it. So it just elevated me to a whole nother level. And, you know, we had a lot of success there. But an amazing person. She's going to push, she pushed me to be the best, but also off the court, just to challenge me to be, you know, a role model, challenge me to, you know, take care of my academics. This was a situation where, you know, I was able to move off campus after my sophomore year. I had over a 2.5 GPA, and Coach Summit, mm-hmm. I go in her office, and she's like, what's your plans? Are you going to move off campus? And I said, yeah, moving off campus. One of the track girls is going to be my roommate. She said, no, you're not. And I look at her, she says, because just as great as you are of a basketball player, you can be an even better student. And she challenged me. And I was upset, and I was angry. But the next two semesters when I went back to school, I had over, like, I think it was like a 3.3 and a 3.5 those next two semesters. And, you know, without her challenging me, yeah, I probably would have just continued to coast because I could, you know. She's like, you come from a great high school, a great academic background, so I know you can do the work. And, you know, she made me step it up.
Yeah. What do you think you and Pat have in common?
I think the thing where we connect is our hearts. I'm really, like, a lot of people don't know, but I'm a big teddy bear. You know, I want to make sure, you know, everybody's okay. And, you know, my college teammates that really know me, they're always calling me, Meek, you can't take care of everybody. You got to take care of yourself. You know, I learned to, like, put a lot of people first. And that's the same thing, like, Coach Summit. I mean, she's a mother to these girls year in and year out, and she takes on that responsibility. And you just see her heart. I mean, she's always cooking for the players, going above and beyond. You know, she wants to be that mentor, that second mother in her life. And that's the same thing, like, I try to do for a lot of young people, you know, that's grown up in, you know, similar situations as myself that have no hope, you know, tough family situations. I try to be that support. And, you know, at times it can be tough. And I know, like, I was a knucklehead and Coach Summit wanted to strangle me a couple of times. There's some kids that resist me, but you still want to keep giving. So I think that's where we connect.
Right. You said that Pat wouldn't let you move off campus, so it surprises me when I saw in your bio that you actually was in a sorority. You were an AKA. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
So you were allowed to pledge while you played basketball. That's rare.
No. Let me tell you about that. You know, I go online while I'm at the University of Tennessee, and basically I'm gearing up to do everything, and Coach Summit found out, and she's like, listen, you're not here on to be in a sorority. You're here on a basketball scholarship, and you need to focus, host club. So I had to stop that. So since they knew that I really wanted to pledge, once I graduated the University of Tennessee, they inducted me as an honorary member
into
the sorority.
Mm-hmm. I saw that and I said, Pat is slipping. How did she become an AKA while she played basketball?
I mean, Deidre Charles was probably like the last one. That group, Carla McGee and Deidre Charles, they all, you know, AKAs, and I think Delta Sigma Theta.
Right. So you helped build a dynasty at Tennessee, winning 3 national championships. You later went on to become the first round draft pick in a WNBA for the Washington Mystics in 1999. I remember exactly when that happened because we all thought that you were going to get the first $1 million contract. So we were all waiting to see if you got that. And then once you got in the league, we were all going to play our best game against you and say, look, I deserve to have $1 million too.
Man, y'all were coming at my head.
Oh, yeah, we were coming for you now because you weren't even there yet. You were still in college, and they were saying, she's the best player for women's basketball of all time. We were like, what? She hadn't even touched the WNBA ball yet. So that happened in 1999. You also played USA basketball and won gold medals. You played overseas. You've had your own shoe contract. You were endorsed by Gatorade. You were on commercials. You were named Naismith Player of the Century for the 1990s. Most people just get Naismith Player of the Year, and that's a huge accomplishment. But you were Naismith Player of the Century. You were even on a Wheaties box. Every player's dream is to be on a box of Wheaties. That's when you know you've made it. You were on a Wheaties box. And so, as great as you were, fans thought you had the best life ever. You had money, you had fame, but the truth was that you were very unhappy. You had some problems when you were in the WNBA. The Washington Post described it as your little secret depression. And at one point in time, you even walked away from your team. Talk about that timeout period of your life.
Wow, that timeout moment was very, very difficult for me. You know, I was living my dream. My family didn't really understand. You know, they see the success. You know, they see us going to the nice restaurants after the game. They see the billboards around town, everyone I'm wearing my jerseys. But when I first went to the league, people have to understand, it was kind of unheard of. You know, I was probably like that player still that, you know, like you said, they're saying $1 million, you know, contract, all this hype around it. And I had really no one to help me handle that. So it was overwhelming to me. And I had to deal with a lot of stress and, you know, a lot of pressure, you know, being in a big city sort of by myself. I had always had like a protective background. I had my grandmother to protect me. I had Coach Summit. Here I was living in D.C. by myself. But, you know, I managed. You know, it was tough. But then that second season went on, you know, things were going pretty good. I was trying to, you know, sort of like assess the situation, just going out there playing hard. But then you're the number one pick. And it was just like so much pressure on me. And I didn't have a release. I didn't know, you know, who I could talk to. I know Coach Summit was there for me a lot. You know, she would come down and try to, you know, help me out. It was, like, sort of hard to talk to my teammates about it because, you know, people don't necessarily understand. You know, they don't understand, why is Meek complaining about this? You know, I even told Coach Summit, like, she set me up for failure because I played for, like, the best coach. I consider her the best coach in the game. Then I go to the pros, and, like, I'm like, man, you know, the coaching is not the same. You know, I'm frustrated with that. And then, you know, 2002, I lose my grandmother. So I'm like, oh, my God, when I'm finally starting to figure things out and become comfortable, bam, like, I lose the most important person in my life.
Wow. So you battled with depression, and it was your little secret. Your teammates didn't know about this. Did your coach know?
No one knew. It was something that, you know, I've struggled with as a kid. I used to go to you know, therapy. I used to go to Al-Anon and Alateen. Even in college, you know, when I found out that my dad was schizophrenic, you know, I needed some help, so I would go to therapy when I was in college. But like I said, when things are going well, you end up, like, sweeping it under the rug, which is, like, a bad thing to do. Like, I look back, I'm like, man, you got to start to address things, like, head on in your life, you know. You got to address those things, because when you sweep them, sooner or later they're going to come to a head, and that's what happened. You know, my grandmother passed away. Oh, my God, like, it was probably like it was the lowest point of my life. It was the lowest point.
All right. You wrote a book called Breaking Through, and it's subtitled Beating the Odds Shot by Shot. Talk about what was the message that you wanted to get across to your readers by writing that book?
I always felt like, you know, I always felt like an enigma. Like, you know, you have the person that meets you, and they're like, oh, my God, Meek is this great. You know, she's an awesome person. But then sometimes they may see an action by you, and they don't understand. So I really, you know, I'm a real transparent person. My, you know, people close to me know, you know, I'm going to open myself up and just, you know, because I know it can help somebody else. So I just wanted to share with everyone, you know, you're going to go through things in life, you know, things are going to beat you up, but you just got to be persistent. And I felt like through my journey, you know, professional basketball, even growing up as a kid, my situation some, they're going to look at it and say, oh, my God, it sucked. I can't believe she grew up like this. But you know what? She had an amazing career. She had the success. She was financially able to take care of her family. But then I had another hit that knocked me down. But, you know, still, I rise. And so I just wanted to say, no matter what happens, you know, I'm not going to get discouraged. You know, I'm going to come back. So all the opportunities that I've gotten, you know, I tried to make the best out of them. And not just help myself, but help others. And, I just believe that's, you know, that's my calling. You know, I used to get really down about things and say, man, I can't believe, you know, I acted like this or this situation has occurred. But I understand now that, you know, this is what I had to go through to get where I am today. So, you know, I just take one day at a time, so.
Right. That's all we can do. Mm-hmm. And so in your book, you talked about your bout with depression and even being suicidal at times.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to young people who may struggle with that? Like, how do you break out of that? You know, there's a lot of people who maybe can't afford counseling and they don't know what to do. And they're in a funk. They're in a depression. They don't know how to do this on their own. What would be your advice to them?
You are not alone. See, the thing about it, when I was going through it, you think, I am the only one going through it. But once you realize and open up your mind, you know, a lot of people are struggling with this. And it's always good. I mean, everyone, like you said, I meet a lot of people. I can't afford to go to therapy. Some people don't want their job to find out that they need therapy because their premiums will go up, things like that. I mean, just talk to somebody. Sometimes just, you know, venting to a friend just really helps you. And I always encourage, you know, people on the other side, you know, just sometimes people don't need advice. They just need someone that sits there and just listens, you know, to be that soundboard, you know, just to support them, right, to rub them on the shoulder. And I think a lot of times, you know, that's what I needed. I had just like this pain. It was just like a pain that I didn't want to die. You know, when I did that, I look back, I didn't want to die. It's just the pain that I was feeling. And I felt really like almost, I hate to say this word, but like constipated with thought, you know, like this Van Zant said,
wow.
I'm in my head a lot. I felt like I had no release. Like no matter what I said, no one would understand. And this was going on in my head. Everything was like replaying all the time. Like I had nobody to turn to. When in all actuality, I had amazing friends, you know, and that I, you know, and family that I could have talked to about that. So, you know, I'm glad that, you know, I was able to, you know, I didn't take my life, you know, that I was able to get through that tough period. But, you know, I understand there's a lot of kids out there, you know, as I travel and I speak to groups that, you know, break down in tears because they've been there and they don't know what to do. And, you know, I just want to hug them and, you know, and just encourage them to just, oh, hey, don't keep it bottled up. Express yourself, you know. If you got to go, you know, to a stranger and just, you know, cry, let it out, do so.
Right. After your book, you started doing a lot of book signings, speaking with at-risk youth groups, and I'm your friend on Instagram, so I saw all the photos with kids, and I saw where you and Ron Artest spoke at an event, and it seemed like you were in a really good space. And then November 15, 2012, you had another major timeout moment. Talk about that situation. And first of all, explain to us what led to that timeout moment.
Well, you know, that was a mismanagement of my emotions. You know, I look at that as a part of just when I really started to grow as a person. You know, like I said, I accept full responsibility. You know, I apologize to the victim's family as well as my family. But, you know, I'm just glad that I was able, you know, to really face it like head on. You know, it was tough. You know, it was really tough for me because I'm like, Shamika, what did I do? You know, I could have hurt someone. You know, I could have hurt myself. You know, this is not me. This is not who I am. And you know, I snapped, and it was a hard, you know, going through that whole legal aspect of the situation. People had no idea.
Did you get into a fight with your ex? I mean, like, explain to us what led up to this moment.
It was just, you know, just like some relationship issues. Now that I look back, it's not even like worth talking about. It was just like some things that just occurred. Just like petty stuff, you know. And, you know, it's like sometimes you just carry your heart on your sleeve. That's basically it. And, you know, that's over almost a year ago, you know, coming up. So, you know, it's something that I can't dwell on no more. I'm, like, so past that, you know. I'm just glad that everybody's okay and everybody can go on with their lives and just, you know, put this behind them. And it was a great learning experience because I had so much guilt. Like, walking around with guilt will kill you. I'm sleeping every night with cold sweats. Like, I just was scared, you know, going to court, you know, having to get these big-time attorneys, you know, not knowing what's going to happen, waiting on phone calls when your next court appearance is, you know, having an assistant district attorney really coming for your neck in court. I mean, this lady was trying to bury me. You know, it was really uncomfortable situation. And, you know, I just thank God, man. It's crazy, too, because, you know, that summer, you know, I had recommitted, you know, my walk with Christ. And so I'm like, man, when things are finally going so smoothly that I'm like, pulled, like the devil gets me in this funk again, you know? And I was just really disappointed in that. And I could not, to get out of this whole funk, the sweats and everything, I would say I had some amazing friends, but most importantly, it was God. It was God. I always tell my friends, they get mad at me now, because I'm like, it was no man. It was him that got me through this, because what I would do, I would be praying, you know, wake up in the morning praying, at night praying, you know, going to church. The only thing that gave me peace, so I'm in church. Like, I go to church on Saturday, church on Sunday, meditation. I was going to meditation Tuesday, church on Wednesday. Like, that was the only place I felt at peace. The only place.
Right. So for those who are listening who don't know the whole story, on November 15th, Shamiqua took a bat to her ex's car and smashed in the window and then shot a bullet in the back of a car. Shamiqua, we'll talk about the court hearing, because that had to be tough, right?
Oh, wow. That was tough. I mean, just to hear them, you know, charge you with all these things, to be embarrassed. The toughest part for me was when I was first, that first night in jail, that was really tough. And when I had my bail hearing downstairs, because the cameras were in the courtroom, the judge said, okay, listen, my attorney says $50,000 bond. And he says, no, I'm going to deny that. The DA started arguing, so they say $100,000 and ordered me an ankle monitor. Then you turn around 5 months later and you go to court, and the higher judge is like, I would have never put her on an ankle monitor. I mean, this is a person that's been in the community. She's not a flight risk. You know, why does she have an ankle monitor? So I had to deal with that. I mean, imagine 5 months I had to walk around with this device. I mean, I had to change gyms, media showing up at my gym. I had to, like, you know, I still got to try to have some type of life. So basically for 5 months I was just pretty much, like, in the house. I started getting out of my funk, doing things with my friends, but every time you look down, you see that monitor. You're reminded of your actions, and that was really, really tough. But it caused me to really humble myself anymore. You know, I'm a pretty down-to-earth person, but it really, really, really made me just dig down a little deeper and just, you know, pretty much give it all to God.
Right. Have you forgiven yourself?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I have. And I thought that was the major thing. You know, a lot of times we try to be perfect, you know, in perfect eyes. Nobody wants anyone to know about their baggage and their dirty laundry. And I had to realize, I was like, Shamiqua, like, I joke with my friends. I always say, every time I wake up in the morning, I look in the mirror and I said, Shamiqua, you are not perfect. And then I turn to the right and I say, you got it. And then I turn to the left, and I used to say, they want it. And it's a big joke. It's a big joke, but, you know, I do say that. You know, I used to have to say it to myself. I'm like, you know, to give myself that confidence to get through this. But, you know, to know that people make mistakes, you know, I'm not perfect. You know, I'm sure I learned my lesson. I will never, and they say never, but, and like the judge said, in 35 years of your life, you've never been in any trouble. So I think everything is going to be okay. But, you know, these next 3 years, you can't get any trouble. I'm like, man, when I go out and hang out with my friends, I don't even drive anymore. Like, I'm like, I'm not getting in any type of trouble.
Right. So let's transition to your show, the show with Iyanla, Fix My Life, that was on just the other day. It was actually filmed in July, but it just aired this week. Iyanla said that you were saved by your grandmother, who failed to you were raised by your grandmother who failed with her child. And while you were on that show, were you able to see the pattern? You know, because your mother felt like she was motherless.
Yes.
And you felt motherless as well. So were you able to kind of see the pattern as she started to talk about that?
Definitely. I mean, to a degree, I didn't agree with it because, I mean, I respected my mother's perspective because I didn't necessarily know my mother's relationship to a large degree with her mother. You know, I knew that my grandmother, from my experience, you know, my mom used to come over drunk and stuff. My grandmother said, you know what, I'm not locking this door or turning away my daughter because that's my child. So when my mother's saying all this stuff, it just shocked me. And then when Ms. Van Zandt is saying, you know, my grandmother was better to me because she was looking for redemption, like I was just like shocked. But, you know, I took in real quick, okay, this is my mother's perspective, you know, and this is what we have to see it through her eyes. I could see the pattern. If she felt this way and now I'm feeling this way, you know, I'm like, man, we have to. That's when I had a timeout moment, and I'm like, wow, like, got to break this cycle. You know, this cycle can't go on.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if your grandmother felt motherless too in some way, and just how long this has been happening in your family. As I was watching that. Yeah,
my grandmother. Yeah, you know, those old Southern families, my grandmother comes from, you know, she probably had like 13 brothers and sisters. So you never know what the disconnect was there. But like I said, for my grandmother, like me knowing her, is an amazing woman, you know. We give her a laugh to anyone. So, you know, at times I felt, you know, pretty bad that she was not there to defend herself.
Right. So during the show, your mom ran out. She literally ran up the bleachers. What was going through your mind when that happened?
Wow. Oh, my God. I said, oh, no. I was like, she's about to go off. But what people weren't able to see is that you saw me sitting there doing some work that Ms. Van Zandt wanted me to do.
Writing in a little notebook.
Yeah, things I wanted to change in my relationship. So I'm listening to my mother. What happened was we were so close, my mother expected an embrace, but they had told me to stay right there because I was going somewhere else. And so after I talked to my mother after the show, she said that, you know, she just let all this baggage off, you know, and, you know, she just, it just hit her very hard. And she felt like really embarrassed. Like she just lost, just lost it. And so when she took off, she's like, man, y'all embarrassing me. I'm out of here. She was just dealing with facing her issues.
Right. All right. We have a question from someone from New York, from 850 area code, Minerva. Are you there?
Yes.
Do you have a question
Hello.
For Shamiqua?
Yes, I do. How you doing, Shamiqua?
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. My question is, how did you handle coming from a major city to touring around the world and opening up to people, meeting new people and everything? Because I know coming from New Jersey myself and New York, we used to walking around with that face, like, don't touch me, don't bother me. And I'm still like that. Although in my business I have to communicate with others and get to mingle, but it's very hard for me to do so. So how do you handle that, and how do you go about doing that?
Well, for me personally, you know, being involved in sports and, you know, traveling at a young age, that, you know, I was exposed to a lot and just meeting a lot of different people. And it really hit me when I went to Tennessee for college, because I remember flying in and I'm like, I'm a city kid. And here I am, you know, going into this city with cows and, you know, not a lot of people that look like me.
Exactly.
So it was really different. But, you know, I just, you got to just let that guard down, you know what I'm saying? Let that guard down and be willing to, you know, open up and try new things and new experiences.
Okay. Do you think that had, like, more of an impact on you, too, to, like, have to open up to so many people at so many times? It could get crazy.
I'm sorry, repeat that question.
Do you think it had much of an impact on you to needing to open up to so many people at so many times? Like,
definitely.
Could just get so crazy and, like, just a rush to where it just can make you crazy.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I, you know, at times you feel overwhelmed, you know, here, you know, especially in the beginning of my career, you know, everybody wanted a piece of you, not just professionally, but your family, you know, everybody wants to be around you. And at times it was just really hectic. But what I learned, you know, a little later in life is that you just have to have that me time, you know. Yeah, you have to take time for yourself and make yourself a priority. You can't just go around helping everybody else and not helping yourself.
Well, thank you for your question, and if you have another question, you can press 1, and we'll put you back on. Thank you very much. Chimiqua, going back to the show, we were talking about your show with Iyanla. What I love about counseling is that with a third party present, you're able to see or hear the other person. You know, in your case, you were able to hear and see your mother through another person's eyes or ears from a different perspective. Was it helpful for you and your mother to have a third party present when you had this meeting to try to hash this stuff out?
Oh, definitely. It was a blessing in disguise, that mediation, because, you know, I had so much anger towards my mother. And even though, you know, for the most part, we celebrate all holidays together, it was still like I was very closed off. Like, I love her, but I wouldn't let her in. And I would just constantly, like my mom said, every time I would, like, bully her and I get upset with her about something, I hang up on her, she would take it out on my stepdad. So I'm making her angry, and then she's making him upset. So when we sat down there and I could just, like, look in her eyes and hear, you know, hear her speaking from her heart, It really changed me. I'm like, wow, I had no idea of her journey and her struggle.
Right. And so, you know, during that show, what was very apparent is that hurt people hurt people. And I think Iyanla even said that on the show. Was leaving your mother nosebleed tickets a way of putting your mom in time out, so to speak, and getting even with her for the pain that she caused you?
Definitely. I mean, it wasn't even me, like, leaving her tickets. I guess she would just come to the game and get them. So, like, I went here. I didn't want anything to do with her at certain points, because I felt like all of a sudden you want to be there. It was just very uncomfortable for me. I mean, here I am, used to come to my games drunk, you know, as a young kid, and it was so embarrassing. And I was just like, man, I didn't trust her. Like, I just couldn't have her there with me. But it was a way for me to say, like, be mean, like, you don't belong here. Like, it's all about my grandmother. It's all about my grandmother, just to kind of rub it in her face, yes.
So now can you see how that was painful for her to, you know, she, on the show, it almost seemed as if it hurt her to feel like your grandmother took you away from her, you know. So when she made the statement about she almost wished that you and your brother went to foster care instead of going to your mom, I could see your whole demeanor just switch. It was almost like something snapped, you know, and you were very angry about that statement. But given what you just said, you know, you wanted her to sit in the nosebleed section because you wanted it to be all about your grandmother, and she didn't deserve to sit down there. Now, after being on Iyanla's show, can you see how that could have been very hurtful for her and why she would even make the whole, you know, foster care statement?
Oh, definitely. You know, one thing, you know, my grandma used to always say is, like, you know, you have to learn have forgiveness in your heart. And, you know, I was a brat. You know, I didn't forgive my mother. I learned when I was young, my grandmother with the Alateen, that, you know, alcohol was a disease. And I watched my mom, like, people understand, I watched my mom go to rehab once, and the day she came out of rehab, I watched her 2 days later take a drink. So I was heartbroken by that. I watched her when she came out of that rehab, Sylvia. She told the lady, she's like, I can't wait to get me a beer. And I was so upset, and I was so angry. So then, you know, to watch my mom go to rehab again and, you know, to see her make it through, I should have been more forgiven, because I knew that it was a disease. And to see her fight so hard to get her life on balance, I should have had, like, a little more respect, and I should have opened my heart, you know. But again, you know, I was being that brat and not a forgiving person.
Right. We have another caller from area code 443. Tyrone mm-hmm. has a question and a compliment, actually. Tyrone, are you there?
Yes, I am, and thank you for having me. Let me just start by saying this is an excellent interview and excellent show. And, Shamika, this is Tyrone from Live to 100. First and foremost, I just want to say thank you for sharing your story, not only with athletes, but just with people in general, as well as supporting our organization as far as healthy living is concerned. My question to you, Shamika, is often when we talk about health and healthy living, we always talk about the physical attributes, but you've been a stand-up spokesperson for mental health as well, which is extremely important. I would like for you to elaborate just a little bit on, you know, for athletes particularly, about the mental stability that they need to have to be successful, because you obviously played on a very high level from high school straight through college and even in even professionally. So can you elaborate a little bit about the mental health that's, you know, important for athletes?
Yes, you know, when I speak to athletes, you know, of course they want to hear about all the great, like, physical things, but I think mentally, you know, you have to be able to handle, it's like almost like stress management. Especially as kids nowadays, Tyrone, they're used to everything, like, coming so fast. And when they don't get it fast, they're not as strong mentally. They're not able to handle it. They break down a lot more. So I'm always being realistic with them, telling them to be realistic with themselves, you know, setting goals for themselves, you know, and just trying to achieve them. Not stuff that's outrageous, because when you set the outrageous goals, a lot of times, you know, you're not going to achieve them. You're going to beat yourself up, you know. So just being able to understand that everything you're not going to get so quickly. You're not going to be able to just, you know, one day just get things, like, so quickly. Just to really try to have balance in your life. And I think a lot of it is also having that support by, you know, a family member or another coach. I think that's really important, keeping these kids, you know, humble, just not using them as a physical toy, you know, trying to get everything out of them, but making sure that they're prepared, you know, if they're going to go pro, if they're going to go to college, to realize what it's going to take, you know, academically, you know, it's going to be hard, you know, it's going to be an adjustment moving to a different city, you know, you might be moving to the city, to the country like I did, so just preparing them to be overall person, so that you're prepared, you know, physically, mentally, and emotionally. You have to have that, like, total body thing going on.
All right. Well, thank you, Tyrone, for your question. If you have another question, press 1, and we'll put you back through. Shamika, you've been very open about this, about your sexuality, and it was actually your ex-girlfriend's window that you took a bat to, where this whole incident started. I wonder if you went through life feeling like you were motherless, like your mother wasn't there. And I wonder mm-hmm. if you were searching to fill that nurturing void, and if that has anything to do with your sexuality.
You know, not at all. I've been asked that question, hundreds of times, My situation did not occur, you know, my relationships, I don't, like, cling on to someone, so I don't think I'm trying to, like, fill a void for something that I didn't have as a kid. I think they're, like, two separate things.
Okay. Now, on Ayala's show, she said, you only get one mother, and her name is not June. Her name is Benita. During the show, you listened to what Ayala said, but did you hear her? Did you hear what she said, and have you accepted that statement that you only have one mother, regardless of how you feel about her? Have you accepted that statement?
Oh, man, definitely. I really had to, like, look myself in the mirror. I mean, when I look at my mother, I mean, we may not look like a lot like each other because I look like my dad, but just my mother's hands and my mother's feet, you know, we got the same hands and feet, and I know I am her child. I know she loves me a lot. I know that God is good because, you know, she's still here on this earth and we can, you know, work through things. I talk to her every day now. We're like, it's like you saw on the show, you know, we communicate. You know, I'm about to go up there in a couple weeks to hang out with her. You know, she likes to go to amusement parks, so we're going to go, and she wants to take a trip before the summer's over. And, you know, just trying to get it back, because we do have a second chance. You know, a lot of people don't. A lot of people have lost their mothers, but mine is still here, thank God. And, you know, just taking advantage of the time and the opportunity.
Right. I'm happy to hear you say that, because on the show when Ayala said it, you made a smirk like, you know, my grandmother is my mother. I could see your facial expression, so I couldn't wait for this show to ask you that question once you've had enough time to kind of, you know, just process what happened on the Ayala show and really take in exactly what happened. So I'm happy that you were able to kind of accept that statement, because sometimes we replace, you know, there are people who say, this is my father. You know, I know this was my biological father, but this person was my dad, and it's the only person I'm going to call dad. And really, we only have one mother or father, whether we, you know, no matter how we feel about them, that's what it is. So I'm happy that you're building a relationship with her. And I even hear that you guys are planning to go on vacation together. Is that true?
Definitely. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, my mom, she want to go everywhere. I went to Turkey a couple of weeks ago. She's like, why you didn't take me? I'm like, I'm going with my friends. So
now, you know, vacation is different, because, you know, you're in a hotel with the same person for like 6 or 7 days or however long you go. And so that's different from just seeing each other every day, where you can get back home and be like, whew, I'm glad that's over, you know. So that'll be a good experience for you both to go on vacation together.
Definitely. I might have to start by putting, you know, we have to start baby steps. We might have to have our own room. I'm joking. But, you know, it's also, you know, realizing, a lot of it is realizing that me accepting, me and my mom also are opposites. Like, I'm, like, really, really chill, laid-back Leo. She's a Gemini. She's more outgoing. She's super girly. She just wants to go get her nails done, go get her hair done, and, you know, go shopping. I'm, like, I don't want to shop. I'll go get my nails and stuff done, but, you know, it's not, like, number one on my agenda. And so it's just, you know, sometimes she's like, come on, let's go. And I'm like, oh, boy, but I just have to learn sometimes. That is mom, so I got to give a little bit more to make her feel good, you know?
Right. Now, I have a sound bite that I want to play, and then I want to ask you a question about it.
Okay.
If you were to close your eyes right now, what does that little girl want her to know?
I hate you.
Yeah.
I hate you.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Those unspoken things, that's the underbelly of what y'all are trying to mend right now. And you've got to be able to hear it and speak it and see it just to clear it out of the way.
So, in my opinion, that was a very, very powerful moment in the show where Ayala asked you, as a 6-year-old, what would you say to your mother? And you responded by saying, I hate you. After your experience on Ayala, what does the 35-year-old Shamiqua say to her mother now?
You know, I forgive you, and I love you. And because what I realized going through my own trials and tribulations is, like, nobody's perfect and everybody deserves a second chance. And so it just really, this whole thing just opened my heart. You know, that young kid was saying, I hate you, because, you know, she didn't have her mother. You know, she had that mother who was, you know, drunk on a park bench, that mother who was banging on the doors late at night or blasting music, you know, playing Marvin Gaye. That mother that was absent. So I had a lot of anger that I was holding on. But, you know, after realizing that people go through things and people can change, you know, my heart is just, like, open, and I just want to embrace her.
Wow. What are you doing to stop the cycle of lashing out in pain?
Just, you know, honestly, just really just, you know, staying in the Word, you know, really focusing on, like, my meditation. My meditation helps me a lot in calming my spirit and, you know, and just listening to myself and my thoughts and really processing things before I speak and thinking how they can affect other people. I know, like, it's going to be days she's going to make me mad, but, you know, just kind of deal with it differently, because words hurt, mm-hmm. you know. But words really do hurt, because even though I don't read, like, you know, I read, like, CNN every morning, but when I was going through my stuff, I don't come on ESPN, watch ESPN or anything like that. So when I was going through my stuff, you know, my friends were like, listen, you know you're not going to read this stuff. Don't read anything about you. But they were like, we're going to tell you, you know, some things that, you know, people say about you. And I just know, like, when they would, because we got to have you prepared in case we're out and somebody says something to you so you just don't be upset. And I was just like, wow, man, like, really? Like, that kind of, some of the stuff that they told me just really hurt my feelings. It just made me mm-hmm. feel some type of way. So, you know, from my experience, I'm able to, you know, understand how I have to just tone down, you know, sometimes the way that I deal with her.
Right. I was looking on Wikipedia before the show, mm-hmm. and it lists, oh my goodness, you have an incredible resume, Shamiqua. Like, it lists, like, everything from the time you were born until today. And so, you know, and it's so unfair sometimes, because our whole lives are on Google, and people can just learn everything about us. You can find out people's address and everything on there. So,
right.
But when I looked at the very end, it had the court hearing. You know, it had November 15th, which is when the incident happened, and it had the court hearing. And so how do you not let this define you? What are you going to do so that that's not the last thing people see on your resume or when you're Googled, you know? How do you,
you
not
know,
let
I
this define you?
You know, I just, you know, just keep moving forth, you know what I'm saying, and keep doing the work that I'm doing and being transparent and, you know, lifting up these kids and, you know, inspiring, you know, others, you know. Everybody goes through stuff, you know. Everybody has a story. Like Ms. Van Zandt said, everybody's got a mugshot, but everybody doesn't end up in the paper. You know, I have so much light to me, so many experiences, and just, you know, sharing others. And I think when you give back to others, you know, that's like one of the most godly things you can do. And so you're going to – blessings are going to just come down and rain on you. And I've seen that in my life, and I just keep moving forth. You know, I'm not ashamed. See, that's the thing. Like, you know, you can't – it says, like, when you're going through, like, difficult things or something, like, you can't – God doesn't want somebody that puts their head down. He wants somebody that's going to put their head up and keep moving forward. And I'm that person, you know. I'm not embarrassed. Like, people ask me all the time, are you embarrassed that everybody knows about your life? Like, I'm in the supermarket yesterday, ladies, oh, my God, I saw you on the show. Oh, I'm just praying for you. I'm praying for you. I'm like, I'm not embarrassed because – I know, like, this is all for a purpose, you know. This is my purpose in life, to inspire and help others. And I know how many people hit me up on Facebook, how many people write letters, how I've helped them. And so I'm just going to keep moving forth with it, sis. Just keep moving forth and helping others.
Right.
And helping others sometimes, you help yourself. You know, you really realize, wow, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And, you know, I feel that with all my heart.
Right. I know for the WNBA, we called a prayer call, and the women of the WNBA, I have never heard them pray harder before like we did when we prayed for you. And so we were definitely keeping you held up in prayer the night that the incident happened, you know. And even after that, when I got on the call, people would say, you know, just remember Shamiqua, you know. So they just kept you on the prayer list and kept you lifted. We have a caller from area code 704. I believe that is Charlotte.
Okay.
Are you there, 704? This is Maquithia. Are you there?
Marquitha, yes.
Marquitha?
Hello.
Do you have a question for Shamiqua?
A comment and a question. First, Shamiqua, I think you're doing an awesome job by dealing with your issues publicly. And my question is, how are you addressing your mental health issues continuously? I know the show was probably a one-time thing, but are you receiving ongoing counseling, or how is that working for you?
Oh, yes, definitely. That's a great question. You know, I suffer from bipolar 2 disorder. So, you know, I have, like, issues with, like, impulsivity, irritability. So, you know, I have to take medication. So I'm on medication, and I also go to therapy once a week. If not, if I'm out of town traveling, we do it, like, over the phone. But I just know that's going to, you know, keep me healthy. You know, that's something I have to do for myself and to continue, you know, to be in a great space.
All right. Thank you for that question. That was actually a good question. And Shamiqua, I want to just echo what you were saying about how you not let this define you. I think it's by moving on, like you said, but I think the more you share your story, the more you're able to bless other people. And I'm so amazed at, you know, just how open you are and how willing you are to talk about it. And I think the more you talk about it, that's how you deal with it. You know, like you were saying earlier, if you sweep it under the carpet, it comes up at the most unopportune time, you know, and then that's when you have incidents and that's when you end up in a newspaper. And so, you know, I think the more you share your story, the better it is for you and the more people that you help. What's next for Shamiqua? I mean, you've been a rapper.
Wow.
People don't know this, but you rap. I'm not gonna have you say your rap on the show,
like seriously, like all just aside, you know me, like I have my creative side where, you know, I paint and, you know, I write, but I'm gonna release a song.
Really?
Yeah,
you gonna
yeah,
let me beatbox? You know I'm your original beatboxer.
Yeah, for y'all that don't know, me and Phil, and it was Tracy Reed from, right, Tracy? Was it Tracy Reed? Was it me, you? Who else had a group? It was me, you, and someone else.
I can't remember. Tracy Reed.
Yeah, it was Tracy Reed. But right now is, you know, getting my foundation launched. We hope to have it launched by mid-September. And a part of foundation is going to be a program, like a program we're going to run. It's called Mentally Driven, and that's like this whole campaign. And basically it's going to support initiatives and facilitate, like, the optimized mind, you know, body and spirit of individuals through, like, mental health and wellness programs. So we're going to just try to get out, you know, continue the speaking and stuff, because I think that's a big piece, you know, getting out, letting people see you. I also want to get back involved in the game of basketball, so really doing, like, clinics and stuff, but really talking to the kids, being real hands-on, talking to them about life while also teaching them skills. I want to also get them involved in a holistic approach. A lot of inner-city kids, they don't get exposed to, like, you know, yoga and things like that. And those, and meditation, those are things that really help me, you know, de-stress and make me become a better person. And also, I want to get involved, like, I want to do some radio, some sports radio, you know, more,
uh-oh,
you know. Yeah,
don't
definitely
let my producer hear that. He'll have you with your next show on Friday.
No. But, you know, I want to get back involved in the game of basketball. You know, I kind of miss it. And, you know, I can still play, so I go hoop, and everybody's like, why are you not playing? But, you know, I don't think that's my calling anymore. You know, I go back and forth with it because I still think I have another year a two in me, but you know, I'll pray on it and see what doors God opens up.
So I don't know. Maybe, you know, so maybe go back to the WNBA. What do you think about Brittany Griner and just this whole new generation of players? Because you were known as the best women's basketball player. And so now I haven't really heard that for a while until Brittany Griner came around. And now they're saying that, hands down, she's the best player that ever played women's basketball. I'm interested to hear your take. And what do you feel about
well,
that?
Well, I mean, people get mad at me all the time because, you know, I keep it pretty honest. I mean, if you're going to say Brittany Griner is the best, why don't you say Della Donna is the best? Because I think she is probably, you know, just performing at an amazing level, you know, a better professional player to me. That's to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah.
You know, you have a lot of great players. You know, there was a big hype, you know. I think, you know, Skylar Diggins, you know, is amazing for the game of basketball. But before she even stepped in the WNBA, it was like, oh, she's going to do this and do that, and she hasn't lived up to it. So I think sometimes, you know, it's that pressure that the fans, you know, put on the players and, you know, before they even picked up a basketball, you know, it happened to me. But you know, I had a little game. I had a little game. But you know, I went through my tough times in DC also, and you know, never really. I would say like, yeah, I had some great years leading the league and scoring and rebounding. Didn't play for the best teams, but you know, I don't think as a pro, I had some solid seasons, but never really lived up to the hype of a female Michael Jordan. I mean, that's some big shoes to fill.
Right. Yeah, and it's. I think Brittany plays a tough position because she's a post player, whereas Della Donna
mm-hmm.
can step out, shoot the three, do some other things where it's harder to stop just one area of her game because she is so versatile. So when I think about like a Shaquille O'Neal. Being the greatest player in the league, I mean, it's tough for centers. You know, it's usually a guard who can do multiple things. And so it'll be interesting to see as the league progresses, you know, if she'll pan out to be what people are saying that she is. And I want to take this opportunity, if you're listening, to encourage you to go to a WNBA game. If you have a WNBA team in your city, go out and support it. These women work hard. And they're playing some of their best basketball right now because the All-Star game is out of the way, so nobody's playing for their personal accolades. They are clawing to get in the playoffs right now. So it's actually some incredible basketball that's going on. So go support your local WNBA team. We have another question from a caller. It's area code 206. Debbie, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, Debbie.
Do you have a question for Shamequa?
Well, I have more of a comment. Hello, Sylvia, and hello, Shamequa.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I just wanted to comment and say just, you know, I know you've heard it 100 times, but how proud I am of you that, you know, Shamequa, you're really hanging in there. And, you know, I look at it sometimes and I can't put myself in your shoes, but, wow, to have to go through all of this publicly, I mean, it can take a toll. And you've done a really good job. My former partner, we were together for 11 years, and she suffered from clinical depression. When we first got together, I was a novice. I was green. I didn't know what it was. And she would go into episodes where she would tell me, she would say, okay, now for the next 4 or 5 days, I'm not going to be here for you. I'll be here physically, but I won't be here emotionally. So she used to go through episodes where she would just go away. She would be somewhere else, and those were all the effects and more of the clinical depression. But I educated myself, and I've learned more now about clinical depression, about bipolar, and I tell you what, it takes a really special person to really be with someone on a day-to-day basis in an intimate relationship that suffers from the clinical depression, but it can be managed by medication. So how proud we are of you out here on the West Coast. I've been a fan of Tennessee for a long time, since Bridget Gordon, and here comes Shamequa. We used to didn't get a lot of TV with the games, and then as soon as you came along, Shamequa, we started getting the wins, and so we were privileged to be able to get more games on the network and be able to celebrate with the Tennessee Lady Volunteers, the entire program, and you definitely set the bar. I mean, you raised it, you set it, and you kept it up there. And, you know, playing for Tennessee, are those, in terms of the playing as far as basketball is concerned, the game, is that, do you feel that that is your highest achievement?
I think it really taught me about, like, a family, and taught me that, you know, family is not just about blood. It set the standard in my life as far as knowing what to expect from yourself, knowing what to expect from others around you. We had such an amazing mentor in our lives in Pat Summitt. So I would say as far as basketball, my basketball career, I would say that was probably the best decision my grandmother ever made, because, you know, I was like, man, I'm going to go to Penn State or the University of Virginia, and my grandmother said, over my dead body. So, you know, it was a good decision made, and, you know, I love the people down in Knoxville. You know, it's just really a supportive town. You know, I know a lot of people know Knoxville is a very, you know, conservative place, and I would like to know, like, through my difficulties, you know, like, these people supported me. I come to a game, you know, they cheer me. They didn't turn their backs on me, and that's how I know I made the right choice.
Right. Well, Debbie, we want to thank you for your comment as well as your question, and if you have another question, feel free to press 1. Shamiqua, I want to thank you for coming on the show and being so transparent with us. Like I said, you have one of the biggest hearts of anyone I know, and I think tonight our Time Out listeners found out that you're not, you know, this monster, crazy person that the media portrayed. I think mm-hmm. you have an incredible ministry to touch a lot of at-risk kids, people who have suffered from depression, people who are suicidal, athletes who have been injured. You suffered an injury while you played.
Right.
I think you can reach young people about their choices. You know, there are a lot of colleges mm-hmm. that are looking for speakers at the beginning of the mm-hmm. of the year to talk about mm-hmm. making good choices. I think your mm-hmm. platform is huge because of what you went through, and the sky's the limit mm-hmm. for you. All you have to do is open up your mouth and tell your story, and people will be helped. Some people who may have not been as strong as you are. And so, like you yeah. said, you'll have your bad days, but I think that all of this is going to work together for your good. And so what I learned from your story as I watched, you know, your whole life kind of unfold on Iyanla is that there are two sides to every story. And mm-hmm. through using a counselor or a third party, for the first time you were able to hear your mother. I mean, really hear what she was saying. And mm-hmm. And your mother was able to hear what you were saying, and both of you are able to grow and heal your wounds together. But forgiveness is the key to unlock your future. And I want to
yes.
leave our listeners with a quote that is by Lewis Smedes, and it says, "To forgive is to set a prisoner free and to discover that the prisoner was you." And so my heart just smiled at the end of the show with Iyanla. My heart is smiling now because I know you've set yourself free because you've forgiven yourself and you've forgiven others. And so so I'm just going to kind of sit back and watch from afar on Facebook and Instagram and continue to be the proud big sister that I've always been of you. I want you to tell our listeners where they can find your book. You've actually written a book called Breaking Through. And I want you to tell them where they can find your book and how they can get in touch with you if they want to become a fan now of Shamiqua Holeslaw.
Right. First, you can become a fan. You can go to my website, www.holesclaw.com. There's a contact page, so you can email me. You know, I check those things. I respond to people back. My book, Breaking Through Beating Odds, Shot After Shot, you can find it on Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. Some Barnes & Noble have it, some don't, but they will be glad to order it for you. It takes a couple of days, and you'll have your copy. And just thank you, everyone, you know, for the support through the good and bad times. And, you know, we all go through things, but we just got to keep pushing forward.
We fall down, but we get up.
Oh,
that
please,
is my
don't
time.
Don't sing.
I sing and rap and break dance. That's my time. This is Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I will see you next week, same time, same place. Our guest next week is Bishop Lester Love out of New Orleans. If you don't know who he is, Google him. He's one of the singing bishops. I'll see you next week. God bless and good night. Take a time out.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, even a Bentley Benz, but you moving kind of fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.